a couple of days ago, News Limited ran a story about you, Brett, and which one of the best headlines of the year, I think, which was Brian McFadden, beware, the man who wrote I Like to Dissect Girls has designs on your girlfriend.
I don't even know who Brian McFadden is. I don't even know what is going on. One little tweet, one little comment about, I don't know, Australia's sweetheart, and now every single question, every single interview starts off with something about Delta Goodrum. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I even made the comment. I don't know.
I'm sorry I started every interview exactly like all the other ones.
Oh, no, it's fine. But most of them start that way anyway. It's okay. This is just crazy. What are so many people doing here? What's going on?
We love you.
I love you too. I totally love you too. That's why I'm here. Oh, and you're trash too. Okay. I'm not there yet, but I will be. I will be later tonight. Unbelievable.
We'll stay with music just for a moment.
Okay. All right. Just get my bearings. Let me get my bearings.
And we'll move away from Delta Goodrum.
Calm blue ocean. Calm blue ocean. Calm blue ocean. Yes, I'm ready.
The titles alone, Lesson Zero and Imperial Bedrooms, an Elvis Costello song and an Elvis Costello album, more than suggest that music is important to you. What do you listen to? Is it part of the writing process, listening to something?
You know what? I was thinking today while I was being waiting to be interviewed by someone, I was like fooling around with my iPhone and I also had my iPad near me, and I thought, you know, I really think it would be very, note to self, write an essay about how technology has changed our lives. I was thinking about that. Yeah. That's what I was thinking about.
Would you like to try some of the ideas out from the essay here?
It was a joke. It was a joke, but it kind of played it out. But I've been thinking about that a lot. I've been thinking about that a lot. Ennui, kind of like heavy sadness, is settling down. This is the end of the Australian tour. This is like the last date, the last gig of the tour. And I'm getting into that mode of, especially after something like this, where I'm getting a bit depressed.
Oh.
I am getting a bit depressed. It's that thing where you are in front of so many people and everyone is really so nice to you and you meet hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people at an event and then you're alone. You go back, you're exhausted, and you go back to your hotel. And it's that, John Mayer tweeted about this. He said, rocked 30,000 in Denver, alone in Denver hotel room, and he tweet picked a little sandwich that he had that was by the bed at about like 2:20 a.m. I was like, yeah, I mean, I don't do that, but I get the feeling. I understand the imbalance of like all the love that you feel, and then basically on a book tour you're left alone to your own devices and have to get up the next morning, so you take, you know, sleeping pills, some mineral water, maybe you play a Delta Goodrum song to get to sleep. That's it. That really is what it is. So I'm feeling a little, I don't know, there's a little bit of sadness about this whole thing. And I also was thinking about the idea that, because I was asked about Delta Goodrum a lot on this tour, and I realized that me admitting my fondness for Delta Goodrum tells you more about me as a writer and a person than an hour of me discussing my process, what it means to write a novel, if music means anything to me. I don't know. And I'm not, believe me, I've been attacked for ignoring the interviewer often on these things. And it's not personal.
No, don't worry. It's not personal at all. If I don't say anything, I'll be more than happy.
I've just been thinking a lot about this tour and the people I've met on this tour and the Australians I've met and all the lines where I've signed books. It's kind of similar to America. There's always like the really pretty 25-year-old girl who comes up with a copy of American Psycho and leans in and whispers something that I can't quite hear at the signing. And she said, this is my favorite book. And I would go, yeah, that's fantastic. What's your name? Why? She said, it taught me how to masturbate when I was 14. I get that. And then I get like, Then I was at another signing, and this young man, about maybe 23, 24, leaned into me while I was signing his books and said, and I said, what? Yeah, so what would he say? And I said, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. And he said, Your novels helped me deal with and come out with my bisexuality, to which I said, I'm so sorry. I am so, so sorry about that. I wish that hadn't happened. Oh, and then also very moving stuff, very moving stuff. A surprisingly large number of young men who were very moved by American Psycho. I mean, by Lunar Park, sorry. I got the two mixed up. Well, they were moved by American Psycho too, but in a totally different way. And that they had given copies of that book to their fathers as a way to mend some kind of like relationship problems that they were having. So anyway, I'm doing like my greatest hits fade out of Australia right now in front of a bunch of people. Feels kind of like a dream. Feels like a dream.
The first date that you did on your Australian tour was the Byron Bay Writers Festival.
Yes, it was.
And that was your first touchdown in Australia?
It was. It was with Ramona Cabal. Cabal? Yeah, Ramona Cabal. Does anyone know? You know who she is? Yeah, it was with her. Very nice woman. Very intelligent woman. I have no problems with Ramona. She has many problems with me. I have no problems with her. I like her. I think she's nice. I really do. And that's not, I'm not being ironic. It was the wrong moment. It was the wrong interview at the wrong time. And actually, I heard a bit of it when I was Googling myself late last night. And I saw that she had posted like half an hour of our conversation. Cleaned up a bit. But yes, she was admittedly pissed about the fact that I froze in front of her audience. It was my first time in front of an Australian audience in Byron Bay, and I got out. There were about 300 people, and it was being shot and taped and whatever, and Ramona's sitting there with all these questions, and I froze. I really did. I froze. She introduced me. It was a very nice introduction, and then she asked a question that had about four or five other questions in it, and then she also like answered two or three of those questions, and then it was my turn. And I felt like I was in school, like being quizzed, and to break the ice, the first words that came out of my mouth at an Australian interview in front of at an appearance was Delta Goodrum. I would like to talk about her. And Ramona said, I don't even know about this woman. And I said, well, I saw a video on Music Max, and I thought she was really kind of hot, and I really liked her, and I liked the song, and you know, it's, you know, she's like, you know, this is the life, is this my life or whatever. She's stomping around singing about how her like persistence makes a difference, and like, you know, she's stumbled and she's fallen, but she's back on her feet again. And like, and then there's another version of her where she's like on a beach, writhing in the sand, playing a piano, singing, this is my life, this is my life. I love it. I actually love it. I really love it. And so that is ultimately what I talked to with Ramona about for about 5 to 10 minutes of the interview was Delta Goodrum. And I didn't know anything about Delta Goodrum at all. I just had seen this image and heard the song. And Ramona Cavalli, by the time I was in my second monologue about Delta Goodrum, she had put down her pad and crossed her arms and was kind of glaring at me. And then she made this totally rude comment that she interrupted me and she said, you're too old for her. And it was like, whoa, where did that come from? That was such like a biting, vaggy statement to make to me. I really didn't get what that was about. And so, but actually it was a bit of a slap in the face because then I did concentrate on the interview and I did give her the kind of semi-coherent answers that she requested from me. And this is the problem with this whole thing, this whole illusion of the book tour and of the writer on tour. There are some writers who are really quite good at it, who do this for a living. No, they do. They get paid to do appearances, and they're out all year long, and they like do this like, you know, every week or something like that. And I only do this like every 5 or 6 years. And it is a huge disconnect between why I write a book and why I'm here right now. And that is kind of what the problem was. And that's why the Delta Goodrum thing is ultimately a positive thing and an interesting thing, because it did let me share with an audience kind of what my tastes are like and where I'm at as, you know, as an artist. Yeah. Other people up there too.
Whoa. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it happens to a number of authors, and you say, it seems to happen to you a lot, is the conflation of the characters that you write and you. So the fact that you talked about Delta Goodrum would have, well, it, I believe it was shocking because a number of people replied to your tweet about Delta Goodrum in quite unflattering terms.
I don't get it. I mean, I really didn't, I mean, before I went to bed that night, I did, I tweet very infrequently, but I was listening to a lot of music that I really liked, and I mentioned like The Replacements, who are like the National, my new favorite band, and then I also mentioned I was listening to a Delta Goodrum song, and then I like went good night and went to bed. And then the next morning when I got up, I couldn't believe how many reactions I got to this one thing, and I couldn't figure out what it was, and I kept reading it, and so someone said, "I've lost all faith in you as an author for liking the song." And I'm saying, "What? What song? What?" And then someone else said, "I'm very sorry that she has cancer, but I still think she's a fucking sow." I mean, and I'm saying, "Who is this person?" And I'm sorry, Brett. She's taken. She's with Brian. They're very happy. And I said, "Oh, they're all very upset about my Delta Goodrum tweet." Yes, you and I, and you all have a very complicated relationship with this woman. The Australian public has a complicated relationship with her. I've said this over and over again. I don't know why you just don't let it go, you know? She doesn't seem that bad.
No replies to the fact that you were listening to The Replacements or, you know,
no,
anything?
Zero replies to The Replacements, a few replies to The National, about 395 to Delta Goodrum. I was also looking, the other weird thing is that I was looking at the tweets while I was in my hotel before I came here, and I was seeing, who's the person having dinner at the Italian restaurant nearby after they see me? Pirandello's or something? Oh, Pellegrini's, okay. That was a cute tweet. That was really cute. It's very, it's odd to be in your hotel room getting ready to go, and then you have your Twitter account and you see what everyone's doing, and the audience is filling up. Ooh, it's Friday the 13th, wonder what's gonna happen. Someone tweeted, "I wonder if a black cat's going to be on stage," and I was like, "Oh, that's so cute. That's so cute." I knew I was going to be okay. I knew it was going to be okay. Are you going to ask me another question? Someone keeps. I'm sorry. Just... Yeah. Okay. All right. We're fine. We're fine.
I will ask you another question. Okay, unless there's anything immediately that you want to talk about.
If it comes to mind, I will go there.
Okay. The new book, Imperial Bedrooms.
Oh, yes. The new book. The book that I finished 17 months ago and that I first thought of about 8 years ago. Yes, the new book. This is the problem. Okay.
Okay,
yes.
I'll rephrase.
The book that I haven't read in a year. This is the problem. Okay, we're going to talk about this book? Okay. Yes, in the new book. Continue. Sorry, it's like, this is the fact. You know?
I might avoid questions about the newish book. One of the things I was going to ask is that I read that the genesis of it was rereading Lesson Zero when you were preparing to write Lunar Park.
Yes, this is true. Okay, that is a true fact. I was writing Lunar Park, and I did want to refamiliarize myself with the narrator that novels work, and the narrator that novels Bret Easton Ellis. And so I did go back, and I read his work, and after I read Lesson Zero, I was driving around one day. This is literally about 8 years ago, and I suddenly wondered, I was at a stoplight, I remember exactly where, I was on Benedict Canyon and Sunset Boulevard. And I, about a day or maybe 2 days later, I was sitting there, and I thought, where is he now? And then the rest is whatever. It's all downhill from there. I couldn't help myself. That's the thing. Writing novels is not a practical or logical thing. I had no idea that reading Lesson Zero, rereading it, was going to become this kind of obsessive thing that occurred, where I had to know where Clay was, and I had to know what he was doing, and whether it was a terrible idea to people who might feel somewhat betrayed by the fact that there's a sequel to Lesson Zero, and that that character turns out far worse than anyone could probably imagine, Well, that really doesn't matter. I mean, what mattered was that I became obsessed, which is a good thing. This is what happens when you write a book. You should be obsessed. And I don't know. I went there. I couldn't help myself.
So did the obsession grow and grow and grow, and then the only way to sate it was to write it?
Correct. That's the process. That's what happens. You don't wake up one morning saying, what am I going to do today? Well, maybe I'll write the sequel to Less Than Zero. I don't know. That sounds like kind of like a good idea. You know, it doesn't happen that way. I was thinking about this. I really, before I even made a note, I was thinking about it off and on for about 2 years. And then a lot of other things happen. And this happens with every novel. You know, you're feeling something. You're going through some kind of pain or stress. Usually that's where a novel stems from. It comes from drama. A novel rarely, if ever, I think, comes from joy. It comes from, like, tension, stress, drama, conflict. And so out of that, my own personal conflicts, whatever they may be, then a narrator is created that embodies a lot of these conflicts and a lot of these problems that I have. And then once I figure out who that narrator is, then a story, what would the natural story be for a narrator like this? What would he be doing? What journey would he be going on? And that's how the books work.
Technically, one of the things you do, I believe, is you write an outline that often ends up being longer than the book ends up being.
Yes, I really should just call it a first draft, because that's what it is. And I've said outline because it sounds so, like, interesting and weird. And part of the Empire, Brett Ellis, part of the old, like, poser trying to be overly literary when, in fact, look, it's a really sloppy first draft is what that thing is. And it incorporates scenes that will never be used. It incorporates long pages of dialogue that won't be used. It also has examples of how I think the narrator should narrate the book and what kind of style. And I'll do tests on certain scenes to see if I'm entering into his consciousness too much. I talked about this before. I talked about the infamous silver wall in a restaurant. That was I was most proud of those five lines of Imperial Bedrooms, and I thought they were beautiful. There was a scene very early on in the novel where Clay is taking a young actress out to lunch who had just auditioned for this movie that he's writing and producing. And I was gonna open the scene, because I've been to this restaurant a lot and I love this wall in the back, and I created this kind of poetic, chilled out, very cool description of the wall, about four sentences long, and I was gonna open it with that and then move into Clay's. Never gonna use it. Clay was never gonna notice that wall. He was never gonna use that kind of descriptive prowess. It was really me showing off. It was me as a writer stepping out of character in a sense and making Clay seem less authentic than he would otherwise be, because he would never notice that. Everything's about him. Everything's very pared down and focused in this book. It's written by a screenwriter. It's his movie that because he's a narcissist, he has forced himself to be the star of it. Yeah, okay, did we, does that correlate at all to the question that
you asked?
I gotta be on message is what my PR person keeps worriedly tugging at my message. You're getting off message. No more, don't talk about certain things. Talk to the book.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you something. You said the Empire, Bret Easton Ellis.
The Empire.
I've read a number of times that you've talked about Empire and, post-Empire,
yes.
In regards to living in New York and then living in Los Angeles.
True.
What's the genesis or the use of Empire and post-Empire?
The Empire was about 1940, American Empire was about 1945 to about 9/11, I would say. And then there was a spike for about 4 or 5 years where we pretended the Empire was still going on. And now the Empire is basically over and we're in a post-Empire world. That's all I mean by that. It is. America is now in its official decline, and that is what is happening in America right now, and that's all I mean by it. And it's not a judgment. It's not saying, oh, when I do these tweets where I'm talking about what was empire compared to what is post-empire, I'm not making any kind of judgment. I'm just stating what I think is a fact. I think Julia Roberts and croissants are empire. I think they just are. And then I think certain things are post-empire. I think, you know, Shia LaBeouf is post-empire. And I think that, I don't know, that various things that mean something to me, I guess.
In an interview.
What's Delta Goodrum? Empire or post-empire? Because some people can exist in the post-empire world but have a very kind of empire attitude about them. So she seems to me to be a combination of someone who thinks she's very empire, but let's face it, we're in a post-empire world, and that's why there are a lot of laughs, and we're kind of having like a jokey dialogue about her, I think. Is that too complicated?
No, I actually think her being an empire woman in a post-empire world is pretty much the best description of Delta Goodrem I've ever heard.
Thank you. I hope I did her justice.
And if she doesn't call her first volume of autobiography that, then she's a fucking idiot.
See, you know how to do it. You know how to relax me. You're not Ramona Cavalli making me like, I feel like a very stern librarian is about to like spank my ass. Or, like, I don't know. I feel like very relaxed now. It's the same way at Byron Bay. There was another interviewer who really just knew how to like just take the piss out of me and like make it, just get onto my level or something. And the interview worked. He got what he wanted by doing that. And you know, he said, I have a really important question for you, a very, very important question for you, but I want to save it for last. I said, okay, that's fine, we'll just do it. We'll ask this stuff and we'll move to that and we'll move to that. And then he got to the final question and I said, oh yeah, what is the final question? And he said, well, it's for my 17-year-old son and he wants to know, why are you so fucking screwed up? I said, that was the best question I was asked at Byron Bay. No, let's talk about how does neutral indifference play in the role in the world? What were you thinking about in terms of Wall Street and the yuppie culture of the 1980s, the consumerist culture that Patrick Bateman finds himself lost in? Oh, God, not again, please. How many times do I have to go there? This is why I don't do this that often. I just like kind of, you know, I hide in my cave. I come out infrequently.
You said in an interview a couple of days, I think it was, quite offhand, that you said that being a worrier makes you a better dramatist.
It does. It makes you also a bit of a lousy human being, but it also does make you a better dramatist. Yeah, a lot of writers I know are very fear-based. Fear-based. I mean, they're afraid of a lot of things, and that causes them to create drama, and it causes them to create very successful scenarios, plays, screenplays, books, whatever. Yeah, it does help a lot if you have that kind of dramatic sensibility. The problem is that sense of drama spills into your real life. It spills off the pages into your real life, and you become kind of a drama queen. And you start making everyone very worried about things that they shouldn't be worried about because you know the statistics about, you know, death and shit and all this crap, and you become not that fun to hang out with. You know, people always say in LA, people, the old line was, you know, never date an actor, never date an actor. But really, the big line in LA is never date a writer. Never date a writer, stay away from writers. They're total drama freaks. They'll, like, drive you crazy with their drama. And I think this is true. But you're essentially correct. I think people who do worry a lot and are fear-based people are more successful at creating, you know, drama.
Talking about writers in Hollywood, there's a scene in Imperial Bedrooms where there's a Clay and a bunch of guys are having lunch, and they're just so brutally honest about the fact that A, he's old, and B, he's a writer, so he has very little power.
Felt good to write. I like that. Letting it go. Writing about myself a little bit. Don't have a lot of power in Hollywood. I'm old in Hollywood. It felt very honest, and I felt like I wanted to go there. I wanted to address that. I liked it. I liked that scene. Because I also get to mention the hills in that scene, which is also my favorite show. Clay drops that he was in New York like last October. He had picked up two girls, and they were in like a hotel room down in Soho, and he says, we didn't have sex, we just did coke and watched the hills. Sounds like my day of heaven. Heaven. I've never done it. I've never done coke to watch the hills. But there's a lot of things that happen in my books that I never do that I kind of, you know, the book allows you to fantasize. And I can fantasize about being with two girls in the Mercer Hotel down in Soho, snorting coke and watching the hills. I put it in the book.
I just wanted to ask briefly about writers whose work you enjoy or respect.
And, oh, it was going so well. It was going so well. And then we hit this.
I knew.
Writers I respect.
Oh. No, well, we can go writers you don't respect. No.
We should go with writers I respect. No, because that's... I am not going to diss other writers. I won't do that.
Well, one of the people I want to talk about was Joan Didion, because...
It's interesting. So Joan Didion is known on these shores. She is excellent. That's excellent to know, because I do go to certain countries where she's not that well known. And I end up talking about her for like 10 minutes to a reporter who, you know, puts down the pen midway through my answer and says, I'm sorry, we haven't heard of her. And it's like, oh, whoa. Yes, Joan Didion was a huge influence on me. I connected with her on many levels when I was a high school student, and I basically ripped her off. She was the writer I ripped off. I wanted to write like her very badly. I copied her paragraphs over and over. Without her novel, Play It As It Lays, there probably would not be a less than zero. It took its cues from that novel and updated them in a way. So she was a big influence on me. But so was Hemingway. And so was Raymond Carver at that time. And it changes. You know, you don't need a lot of influences. You only need about one or two to get you started off as a writer. You don't need like 20 of them. You need like, you know, one or two stylists whose work you like a lot. And that's what it was. She was she was the big one. A lot of respect. And I have to say that I got to know her. I got to know her pretty well. And I do have to say that out of everything that has ever happened to me in my career, the moment that I am, and I didn't do anything, the moment that I was most excited by, proudest of, is when she called me up and said, I want to dedicate my new collection of essays to you. And I really didn't know, I couldn't believe what, I was always so nervous around her anyway that I could barely hear anything she was talking about. And I would go over to her house for Thanksgiving. I was very friendly with her daughter, who is now deceased, but I went to school with her daughter. Her daughter also took, Patana also took the photo of me that's on the Informers. And so when she called me up and told me I'm dedicating this book to you, I don't know, everything went white for a moment and I couldn't hear anything. And then when I realized, I was very calm as she discussed why she made this decision and why it was going to be dedicated to Henry Robbins, which was her editor, and to me. And I don't remember what she said at all. I just remember hanging up the phone and like literally, I fell on the floor. Not that dramatically, it was like to have your hero, one of your heroes, like acknowledge you like that was the number one moment in my career, I think. A long, long way up from being dissed publicly by Elvis Costello, which is way down on the list. Way down, like in the bottom two or three things that happened during my career where Elvis Costello, who was an idol of mine, dissed me in print. Someone found it and posted it here in Australia, the actual interview, where he mimics my style of writing and says that, he did meet me and he wasn't impressed, and that, I was doing blow on a bar and I ordered a drink and then I gave my friend a blowjob and then I did another line and then I walked outside. And Elvis Costello said, I really wasn't that impressed by him. He did. It's online. A low point. That's a moment when you're 22 and you realize this idol of yours thinks you're kind of like a joke. You grow up. You do. You grow a set of balls. You really do.
You mentioned the Informers there.
Ooh, I know where this is going. But it's okay because no one's seen the movie. It's okay. We can talk about it, but no one's seen the film. So it's not, it wasn't even released here, I don't think.
Yeah, well, you described the process of making The Informers as a slow motion avalanche.
I'm a drama queen. There you go again. I'm a big drama queen about it all. You know, it was, look, this is what happens. It happens all the time. And why I'm still talking about it and complaining about it is because it's an adaptation of one of my books. If this was just a job, I'd be totally cool and chill with it. I wouldn't be talking about it. But I was very involved in the making of the movie. I was a producer on it, and I wrote the script. And I felt that we were all on the same page, the director and the creative producer who got all the money to make that movie. It was a very expensive movie. It was like a $20 million independent film to make. Got a great cast because of the script. And everyone signed on, and then somewhere along the way, I don't know if it was the director, the producer, they kind of lost sight of the film, and things began to drop out of it, and what was ultimately made, I don't think is a bad movie, really. It's just unrecognizable from what the script was. And all the actors will agree, too. I don't think there's a single actor was happy with how that movie turned out. And it could have turned out much differently, and it didn't. And that's just how it happens sometimes. It's a miracle if a movie turns out good. It really is. You can start with the best intentions. A great movie is almost like an accident, I think.
You're working on I believe you're currently working on a film called The Golden Suicide.
I am.
Which is the story of an artist, Jeremy Blake, and his girlfriend, Teresa Duncan.
Yes, it means a lot to me.
I wasn't familiar with the story when I read about it, but I don't think it was a story that was widely publicized in Australia. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Without getting too specific about this, they were a couple. She was about 40. When I was researching the script, she was actually 43 when she killed herself. About 13 years older. About 8 years older than him. About 8 years older than him. And they met when he was 23, and I guess she was actually 31 or so. He was an art student. Really handsome, gorgeous guy, very talented. He's the guy who's responsible for the animated sequences in Punch Drunk Love. And he also did some of the videos for the Beck Sea Change record. And they were this golden couple. She created video games, and he was an up-and-coming artist, and she was had a lot to do with his rise, his career rise. And they were this very glamorous couple, and their goal was to get to the point where they were well-known enough in the art world where they can make that transition that was happening with a lot of the artists at that time, whether it was Julian Schnabel or David Sally, where they can make a movie, where they can go out to Hollywood and make a movie. And they did. They went out to Hollywood after they became well-known in the art world, and they tried to make this movie at a studio. A studio gave them a two-picture deal to make a film from a script she wrote. And what Teresa didn't understand is that the movies never get made. They really just never get made. And she slowly began to lose her mind out there. And she was already mentally unbalanced already, but she was keeping it together. And then she lost her mind out in LA, and she went crazy, and she alienated everybody in very, very dramatic ways, and then also dragged him down with her, because he was a very friendly, affable guy, but madly in love with her. And so then they had to leave LA. They were evicted because she was attacking tenants. She was that crazy. But she was also gorgeous, really beautiful girl, and super intelligent, but sick. She was sick. They went back to New York, and then in the summer of 2007, she killed herself. She took some pills and she drank some alcohol one day while he had to get a job again. He was a famous artist, but they lost all the money, and so he had to get a job back at a video game company. And then, so one afternoon while he was at work, she killed herself, and then a week later, he killed himself. And I read about this story in the summer of 2007 when I was in LA thinking I was losing my mind about the film industry, and I was involved with someone who was crazy, and it all resonated. It all resonated. I thought, oh my God, what happened? It just spoke to me in this way, and I became obsessed with this story, and I went around town pitching this story to people, and no one would do it. Absolutely no one would do it. Yeah, two people meet, they fall in love, it's sort of like a biopic, it's a rise and fall story, but they kill themselves in the end. Christmas movie, let's do it, you know, whatever. No one would give us the money. And then Gus Van Sant started circling, and he was intrigued by it, and that helped us finally get the financing to develop the film. But Gus was never attached to direct the film. He was only attached to produce it. I know there's a lot of stuff that he was going to direct it, but he's not going to direct it. And yes, this is the big project that I wrote the script. I wrote the part for Angelina Jolie because I think she'd be perfect for it. And she looks exactly like Teresa Duncan. And what Angelina Jolie does best is play a role like this. And yeah, so that's it. That's The Golden Suicides. And I did get an enraging email this morning from one of the producers on it about, I don't know, a second step or a third step, and he hasn't paid me some money, and I don't know. It's just typical stuff, but it's an important project. I really like it.
Talking about the development of it, and, you know, development of things, the word gets used a lot. How long can the process take?
10, 20 years, I don't know. I mean, it's weird. I mean, because American Psycho took about 9 years to turn into a film. The Informers happened really suddenly. I mean, and it's so weird, it's so random. There are so many more commercial movies than the Informers. And yet the Informers, when we finished that script, until the time we got the money, it was less than 2 years. And we're shooting the film. That is really, really fast in terms of that, in terms of Hollywood. So, there's so many variables, you know? It's one of those things you just have to be patient.
There is a sequel to American Psycho.
Yes, sir.
American Psycho 2, which they were clearly up all night.
What is the rest of the title?
Angrier, Deadlier, Sexier. Which sort of redeems it, at least title-wise.
But it's none of those things. It's misleading. It's not angrier, it's not sexier, it's not deadlier. It's lamer, certainly, but it's not any of those. That should have been the final word on that poster. It's actually about a girl who, I've seen about 30 minutes of it. It's about a girl whose babysitter, I think, was murdered by Patrick Bateman. That's the opening scene. And yet then she kills Patrick Bateman. And then she becomes infected by his spirit or something. And so Patrick Bateman's in it for like 2 or 3 minutes. Some person who really doesn't look like Christian Bale at all. And they solve that by putting some sort of mask on his face when he comes over to kill the babysitter. And then then it turns into a college slasher film. She's on a campus and she is, she's obsessed with Patrick Bateman. And so because she's so obsessed with him, she starts killing people left and right. It's pretty dreadful, and I had no say over this at all. I didn't even know they were making it until they were halfway done, and someone said, you do know that Lionsgate is cashing in on the success of American Psycho with American Psycho 2, which I think was at the time called All American Girl.
Right. Well, that's the thing I wanted to ask is, how odd is A, not knowing, and B, finding out, and just going, wait a minute, this is my...
Oh, stuff. How odd is everything? How odd is this? This is so odd. You know, everything's odd. I was in my hotel, and I'm on all of these things because I'm alone. I'm bored. I'm on tour, and so I have Twitter going on. I have Facebook. I have all these social network sites going on, and I have Grindr is going on. And there's and someone on Grindr says, I couldn't get tickets to the event. I'll put out if you get me in. And, I really wasn't that interested. But you know what? I thought, an interesting story nonetheless. So I said, okay, you don't have to put out. You can come to the Wheeler Center. I'll make sure your name's on the list. And then I got back, well, how will you do that? And I said, because I will tell my PR person to put your name on the list. And then there was a long pause. And then he asked, what do you do to deserve a PR person? And I wrote back, okay, so you're a problem. I get it. This was a legit offer. I'm now rescinding it. That's odd. What you're just talking about is, the other thing isn't so odd at all. The other thing that to me is odd.
Yeah, I stand completely corrected. But
I want to see if he's still, I guess he believed it actually was me. I know this, I know I'm going to go on this, I want to hear the Grindr app go out all over the audience, right?
Are people aware of what Grindr is?
Yes.
Right,
yes.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Let's not talk about it.
Okay. It's a way to meet people and it tells you how close they are. That's the nice way of putting it.
Yeah. I don't know.
And some of them can be very close. Like I mentioned at the moment, it probably says 10 meters.
Yeah, it is. It's really scary when you're in a hotel room someplace and then you get on it and you realize someone is, like, it says 10 feet away. And you look up and you realize. And then sometimes it says 0 feet away and you go, whoa. But wait, I just want to see what this person just wrote me. What does he say? Do you want to go to the Wheeler Center or not at 7:30? Just answer me. Okay, where is it? That's in 2 minutes. That was at 7:32. Oh,
if you're
exhausted.
Here, now is the time to show yourself.
He wasn't on the list. He couldn't get in. He tried getting a ticket. He couldn't get in. No, it's fine. I'm back in the closet anyway. It's not, it doesn't really matter. I tried the gay thing. It just wasn't working out. Is that a real laugh?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. It was. I'm genuinely enjoying myself.
Who was the last person you've interviewed?
Who was Tim Burton?
Oh, interesting. How was that?
It was good.
Was it weird? A bit weird?
Well, he was jet lagged, and we were talking about his five favorite films. One of which was Dracula AD 1972.
I get it, Tim, going through his little Tim phase. And so. That must have been kind of exhausting. I don't know. No? That's one of the greatest films ever made, right? Great, Tim. Great. Everyone has their shtick, you know? Everyone has their shtick. A lot of Tim Burton movies I don't like. I thought the Planet of the Apes movie was terrible. I thought that Charlie and the Chocolate Factory movie was terrible. God mighty. My God. But Sweeney Todd was good. I thought Sweeney Todd was good. I liked it.
Do you interview people?
No.
Wrong.
Well, I have friends who say I cross-examine them often, but I don't feel that. You know, I'm not good at it. I'm really not good at interviewing people. I did, early on in my career, I was offered to do profiles of people, and I did take a couple of them. I did do, back in the day, Judd Nelson for Vanity Fair. Hello. I palled around with Judd Nelson. I actually became friends with Judd Nelson, and Judd Nelson was actually a really nice guy. He was not at all what you would expect him to be like. He was a very smart, very nice guy. And I was hired by Tina Brown, who was then the head of Vanity Fair, very powerful. I was still in college, and she called me up and said, and I met her in New York. I drove up from Vermont to meet with Tina Brown, because everyone said, you have to meet with Tina Brown. She wants you to do something for Vanity Fair. I met with Tina Brown in this very like posh, this is like 1985, whatever, 1986. Very posh, like little like the Royalton or some Ian Schrager kind of hotel. And she didn't say anything. She said, I would really like you to do, it's a soft voice. She said, I really would like to do have you do a piece on Judd Nelson. I would like you to do a piece on Judd Nelson. And I said, oh, okay, yeah, sure, I'll do it. She said, we'd really like you to take him down a bit. We'd really like you to take him down. He annoys me. And I said, oh, okay, but you know, you're 21 and I'm drunk and I'm going, sure. He does seem kind of annoying, actually. Yeah, okay, I'll write a piece about how annoying Judd Nelson is. I'll hang out with him. I'll do the total like journalist trick and like be his friend and then totally fuck him over when the piece, you know, comes out. And then I met Judd and I really, really liked him. And we decided, admittedly, we had some drinks, and I admittedly told him, you know, Vanity Fair really wants to take you down. They find you totally annoying. He said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to pitch to Vanity Fair, because it was the L.A. issue, the Los Angeles issue, and that's why I was asked to do a piece on it, and he's whatever. And so he said, we're going to do it, you're going to pitch back to them. We're going to show you the coolest youth places, because we were both, like, I was 21, he was 23 or whatever. We're going to show you what the coolest, hippest youth spots are in L.A., and Vanity Fair freaked out and said, oh my God, that's so perfect. You guys, of course, would know. We went to every tacky place. You could totally imagine. We went to the worst, like, the tackiest sandwich shops, and we went to, like, the lamest bars possible and said, these are the coolest places. And Vanity Fair published all of it. They sent photographers to take pictures of the places. It was like Philippe's French sandwich dip shop. And Judd and I are standing there, and I wrote these elaborate things about how cool it was and what celebs go there, and Vanity Fair did a huge thing on all of these places, and it was that was fun. But I don't do things like that anymore. The last time I was asked to do a profile, I was really, really tempted, and it was last December. Details Magazine, and if I wasn't so busy, I would have done it because they offered me an obscene amount of money to do it, was to hang out with Rob Pattinson for a couple of days and write the cover story for, I guess, the March or April or whatever issue with Rob Pattinson. And I was very tempted because I know a lot of people who know Rob, and he's actually quite intelligent and likes to drink a lot. And I like to do both of those things, talk about books. And I was one of his favorite writers, and he kind of approved the piece. And I didn't do it, and I kind of regret that. And so next time I'm offered a profile from a magazine, I think I'm in the mood now to do it, but to kind of like go back to that Judd Nelson thing and fuck with it a little bit. Now that I've said it, That's the cat's out of the bag, but how do we get onto this? Oh, interviewing people. Yeah, no, I don't.
Have you ever been asked to write anything else for Vanity Fair?
I never was. They found out about a couple of days after the issue hit the stand, they realized what had happened, and there was really nothing they could do. And I have to say, actually, some of those places became cool. They actually did. And so, I don't know. You can find it. It's like the June 1985 issue of Vanity Fair with Sylvester Stallone with, who was the blonde woman he was with for so long? Bridget, yeah. How empire is that? 1985 Vanity Fair with Sylvester Stallone on the cover. That is, that's height of the empire. Height of the empire.
Yeah. It might be time to ask people whether members of the audience have any questions. We'll take questions for about 10 or 12 minutes. There's a person with a microphone, catch their attention and they'll come to you, but there is a question right at the top.
Sorry, what do you think it says about society and Macintosh in particular, that American Psycho is still doing fairly well on the audiobook section for iTunes?
I don't know. I really don't. What does that mean?
Who?
It's cool. It's cool. It's great. It is.
Who read it? Who does the audiobook version of it?
I don't know. I mean, I listened to about a minute of it and I couldn't deal with it. I don't have a lot of say in who does the audiobooks, and I should have more say. And I don't know why I just don't read them myself, which is what I probably should do, but publishers kind of like, you know, an actor or someone to do it, and I don't know. And also, it's hard to do. I remember when James Vanderbeek did Lunar Park. And I remember that I had to go into the studio, and I had to do, like, a page just for the audiobook. So James does the entire audiobook, and then I get to do, like, a minute. And I remember being in the studio and having to read one of my run-on sentences out loud, and I'd read this paragraph 50,000 times. And then when I was reading out loud in the studio with the mic over my, I kept stopping. I kept stumbling over the sentence. It was like a paragraph long, and I couldn't get the rhythm of it. And then James read it completely effortlessly. And I saw him do it. I said, how did you do that? He said, well, I'm an actor, and I know how to, it's about breathing. It's about breathing, learning to breathe. You told me. Yeah. So anyway, that's all I have.
Okay.
One thing, another picture of the eye.
This is very orderly. I believe there is a line of questions here. Sir, you first.
G'day, Brett. In Lunar Park, when you at the beginning of the book, when you're describing the Glamorama tour, you talk about some pretty serious drug abuse, and I was wondering if it's still happening these days, and can I do it with you?
Well, do you have any drugs? That always helps. I don't look for them anymore. I am, yeah, the other night I had a very sedate evening I guess it was here, you know, it was like publishing people and it was very sedate. I mean, I had to get up very early the next morning and do some press, and so it was a dinner in a lovely restaurant, and then I realized what time it was. I had to excuse myself, I had to go back to my hotel, I had to take a Xanax and some mineral water in order to get to sleep so I could get up the next day to do the press. And right before I went to bed, I tweeted, oh my God, this tour is becoming like the video for Robbie Williams' Come Undone, and it's getting out of control. And the scenes from the video are being replayed in my hotel room nightly. The next morning, I got very worried phone calls and text messages from my friends who saw it and said, are you okay? Are you back to doing coke now? What's going on? You're in a relationship, how could you be doing this? Irony doesn't really travel well. It doesn't. The technology somehow disrupts that ironic flow from going forward. So, but the drug thing, no, I really don't do drugs too much anymore. No, I did them in London at my book launch. people, the Brits have so much blow there because I guess it's so cheap. Because you don't really, you don't see in, like, in American publishing circles where everyone is paid not very well, it's, there's not like a lot of coke around because it's pretty expensive. But in the UK, it's really, really cheap. And it's really not even that good. It's not even that good. And so, yeah, that's a lot, that is the last time I did it on the night of my book launch.
There's a question in the middle
but
here.
But I'm not doing it tonight. No.
G'day, Brett. Three very quick questions that roll into one, and then one thrown on the top.
Can you also answer two of them while you
no,
ask?
No, actually, I can't. Are you sick of Patrick? How much time do you spend with Patrick nowadays, and do I get to play with Patrick again? And the last question on top of that is, do you want my grinder, Nick?
Do I want to... What was the last one? I'm interested in the last question.
Would you like my nickname on Grindr?
Sure, yes.
Excellent.
I've never met anybody on Grindr. I had an opportunity to meet someone on Grindr. I've never met anybody on Grindr. And Patrick... no, I don't think about Patrick Bateman that much. Someone did say... a publisher said... told me, a publishing friend of mine said, you know, you should do a young adult book about Patrick Bateman. You should do a young adult book about his teen years. Patrick Bateman, teenager. Like, you know, because my friend Candace Bushnell did the Carrie Diaries, and it's about, you know, Carrie Bradshaw as a teenager. And someone said, you know what, you'd make a mint. Go back, do Patrick Bateman as a teenager. And, I don't know, it just sounds appalling to me. It's a horrible idea. Though people are interested. People, I have a feeling, would want to, but that's not going to happen. I don't really think about Patrick Bateman. That's a couple. I have a feeling she's sort of with, she's been with some Patricks lately, hasn't she? She's dated a few, she likes kind of the bad boys, huh? I'm not interested. Don't worry, don't give me that look.
All right, another question down here.
I know this is kind of a weird question, but do you ever wish that maybe someone killed you at the peak of your career?
I think you might have to be quite careful how you answer that.
Well, the only answer is yes. It is, yeah. Yes. What was the question again?
Do you ever wish that someone possibly killed you at the peak of your career?
It's okay.
But I really didn't mean that in an offensive way.
Oh, okay. No, I don't. Oh, I didn't hear you. Of course not. Of course not. Funny, that's funny. Okay. No. Absolutely not.
Okay, there's a question right at the top.
G'day, how's it going?
Going good.
A very serious question. Who would win in a tag team wrestling match? Christian Bale with Patrick Bateman or you and James Vanderbeek?
See, this is part of the reason why I don't do this at all. It is a playful question. It is a cute question. I like the imagery a lot. I don't have an answer for that question. I think the question itself is kind of part of the performance art thing that's going on here. And the question speaks for itself. Yes.
Another question down here.
Hi. I was wondering if you could explain the significance.
Oh, wow.
If any, ooh, of the song Sunny Side of the Street.
Ooh. That actually is an excellent question. That's an excellent question. You've paid attention, haven't you?
No.
You have. That, I got a little chill when she asked me that. She's been reading the books. She knows what's going on. A smart reader. No, I can't.
Another question at the top.
Recently, you said you are Patrick Bateman. You finally admitted to that. I was wondering how much your books are your experience. Like, have you ever been smeared and shit and elbow deep?
Is that code for something? What is that? What does that mean? Have I ever been what?
Smeared in shit and elbow deep, fisting someone.
Oh, like, fisting someone, yeah. But no.
Not just that.
No. No. Mostly, and now, okay, but I do want to, I mean, not that I'm judging that at all, but I am not particularly interested in that, and it doesn't really do anything for me. So I can answer that question with some certainty and say, no, that hasn't happened. But then, you know, what you're really asking is the work very autobiographical? And then I start to fall asleep. I start to fall asleep a little bit because it's like, no, but it's nice. I mean, it's fine. I'm not being antagonistic at all. But literally, I mean, I begin to like think, okay, so is the work autobiographical? Yeah, on a certain level, it's emotionally autobiographical. And the minute that I start saying emotionally autobiographical, I start to go, oh, the emotional autobiography of it all, yes. So there's an emotional autobiography, but I don't think that I could point to any scenes in any book that I've written and say, yes, that happened. Which made it so weird when Jay McInerney got so upset over the scene in Lunar Park where we do coke together in my fictional garage, in my fictional town, with my fictional dog watching us. Jay McInerney had a fit when he read that scene. He's invited to a Halloween party at my McMansion with my fake wife and my fake kids and this fake book, this novel. And Jay makes an appearance, and we're like doing some blow off the hood of a Porsche. And Jay had a fit, and he said, how can you put that in? I don't understand. Why did you put that scene in? And I said, I made it up. It's all made up, Jay. He said, but we've done a lot of coke before together. I said, I know, but we've never done it like this, and we haven't had this conversation. So why are you so upset? And he said, I've got kids now. I said, I know, that's why you're so fucking boring. They can't tell. I did. Oh, he was pissed. She was so pissed at me. I'm so pissed.
Now, there are two questions down here, so we're just going to take these two, and then that's going to be the end of it. So, Sue?
Hey, I just noticed that every time somebody tries to adapt your work into screen, they fuck it up very badly. And I've heard that you're going to be working your next big thing after Golden Suicide is going to be a TV show. I'm just wondering how much you're going to be involved in that once it, or if it gets going, or if you're just going to create it and then stand back.
But what's your name?
My name's Angus.
Okay. I thought you were somebody else. You sound exactly like someone else that I was talking to last night. No, it wasn't named Angus. Similar accent. The question was about the film adaptations.
After the film adaptation, the TV series you're talking about doing. I'm just wondering if you're going to actually be involved once that gets rolling, or if you're just creating it and then standing back.
No, I would want to be like the author of the show. I mean, I'm right now doing a second episode for the production team and for the network in terms of they're worried about the tone. Everyone's really into the idea of the show, but there's a tonality thing going on that some executives are having problems with. So I'm kind of just showing them what the show is going to be like aside from the pilot. But I would be, I mean, part of what I think is interesting about television as a novelist is that you really are the author of the show. You might not direct episodes, but, you know, Matthew Weiner's the author of Mad Men, you know, and the same thing with The Sopranos, The Wire, a lot of great shows. They're the stamp of one kind of authorial voice, and it is, in many ways, you know, you watch season 3 of Mad Men, and it's pretty much better than any novel, any contemporary novel you've probably read in the last year or so. So it's a very interesting way to, I don't know. It's more interesting to me than books are right now. I can tell you that. It's more interesting to me to work out whatever I'm going through in terms of, you know, the arc of a TV, a season of a TV series, rather than do a book. I don't know. That's just where I'm at this time. It's not to diss the book at all, or the idea of the novel, though I do think the idea of the novel, we don't want to end this on a very depressing note, but the idea of the novel is changing. Let's put it that way. I'll euphemistic about that. It's changing. Our relationship to the novel is changing. Very much so.
There's one final question down here.
Please let it be, why are you so fucking screwed up? No, I'm kidding.
It's not, actually. As a point, I mean, you are who you are, and we're a bunch of kind of perhaps, I don't know, predominant inner-city hipsters who've come to see you. And I'm coming from the point of, I'm an educator, and it's Friday night, I tell my students, you know, have a good weekend, what are you doing this weekend? And they ask me, and I say, well, I'm actually going to go see this writer, Bret Easton Ellis. And many of them turn to me and say, I don't actually know who that is. What's your experience with people who meet you and perhaps aren't aware of who you are? And do you ever throw your weight around and say, don't you fucking know who I am? Haven't you seen American Psycho, etc.?
I'm thinking 4 drinks or 5 drinks? I'm not sure. 4? What do you think? 3 or 4?
I'd say 6. I'd say 4 because they won't serve doubles at this bar.
As a person,
people, please calm down. It's just a question. It's just a question. It's just a question. What is? The question was really rude?
No, your response.
Oh. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude.
Well, I didn't mean to cause you offense. It was simply an honest question.
No, I know. And it's totally fine.
Yeah, right. So let's just give him a chance to answer it.
Well, no, I mean, look, the answer is this. I mean, I am not in this game to be noticed by anybody. And I don't go out a lot. And I don't do, for the last 5 or 6 years, I have not made any public appearances. So I wouldn't be surprised if some of your students might not have known who I am. And also, I am not recognized. I'm not like an actor. I'm not in movies or television. So I have a very anonymous life. I move through the world very anonymously. People don't come up to me in the street. Occasionally, I'll put my credit card down. People will see the name and say, oh, you wrote American Psycho. So my life is, for the most part, except for something like this, which I do very infrequently, is full of anonymity. I have a very anonymous life in LA. And I hang out with a very small band of friends. And I'm not really that interested in terms of whether people know who I am or don't know who I am. And it's totally fine. If that's the question, like how do I feel if people haven't heard of me, I guess. That happens. Why should everyone hear with me? I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't sell as many books as Matthew Riley. I don't. I was at Byron Bay with Matthew Riley. We were comparing notes. He said, I can't believe I sell so many more books than you. I said, I can't believe it either, Matthew.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bret Easton Ellis.
Thanks, guys.